And now I'd like to introduce our next speaker, Dr. Andrew Smith. Andrew is a state toxicologist for the Maine Center for Disease Control. He directs the environmental and occupational health programs, which include climate and health, environmental public health tracking, childhood lead poisoning prevention, and environmental toxicology programs. Andrew received his master's and doctoral degrees in environmental health from the Harvard School of Public Health. And he'll be talking about extreme weather or extreme heat events in Maine. You've got to be kidding.
Thank you. And I think I just advanced this, my obligatory slide, so no relationships to disclose. So I'm going to touch, I think, on most of the elements that Gino said, but in a very focused way on just dealing with extreme heat events. And not necessarily in the nice logical order that Gino showed, but I'll get to most of them. And really, I'm going to give you an example of a rural state that doesn't experience a lot of extreme heat, starting to think about how we would prepare for it when we really had nothing in place. And a big motivation for that when this funding came out was looking at France in 2003. No one expected northern France to have the heat event it did, and they were totally unprepared for it. And we all know, or many of us know, about the morbidity and mortality associated with that. So there was a lot of motivation to make sure we didn't have a repeat of that in Maine. So when you think of extreme weather in Maine, what you're more likely to think about are winter storms, severe winter storms, especially ice storms, such as the 1998 ice storm, where over half the population of the state was without power for up to 3 weeks in some cases. Major outbreak of carbon monoxide poisoning due to people not being familiar with generators and proper generator placement, et cetera. And then the other thing we have a lot of is floods. And the floods usually are an unusual combination of a lot of rain in the spring coupled with snow melt. And then if those conditions are just right, you can get a lot of flooding, and sometimes the flooding can be severe. What we're less likely to experience is extreme heat events. And they do happen. In fact, every summer we will get a heat wave, and there'll be maybe a couple of these events, but they're usually more like 2 to 3 day events, and they come and they go, and we survive through them. Occasionally, the National Weather Service might even issue an advisory if we cross their thresholds for issuing it. But again, it's somewhat of a rare occurrence. In fact, you have to go back to 1911 to find a heat event in Maine where it went on for almost 10 days with temperatures often exceeding 100. So can it happen? Yes. But the past experience is that they're fairly rare in terms of severity. But people are saying climate's going to change. And there are some predictions that Maine by 2100 will look more like Maryland, I think that's where we are, or New York City, depending on which of the various sort of scenarios you run. That probably means a lot more people will move to Maine if we have weather more like that. But aside from that, it means that we're likely to experience more days of high heat, longer periods of those, and so therefore that's something we need to be prepared for. And that's where it's very fortunate that we were able to apply for and receive funding from CDC to begin to think about building public health capacity for responding to extreme heat events, where really, when we started, we had virtually nothing in place. And so I'll talk a little bit about developing a syndromic surveillance system. So we have a way of doing early warnings to know whether or not we're seeing increases in morbidity or mortality in response to extreme heat events. Beginning to assess our vulnerable populations, specifically towards heat. Thinking about the thresholds for issuing advisories, and I'll talk a little bit about that. Forecasting climate future to help us both better prepare and to engage people. I mean, I made the joke at the beginning that you've got to be kidding, but if you try to engage communities, local emergency management agencies, our state emergency management agency, with all the other things they have to think about, to ask them to think about extreme heat, it is not an easy sell to get them to put resources into that. And then if we're successful at all that, then we can start to work on developing response plans at the state level. So let's start first with the syndromic surveillance system. So the good news, and this is true for probably many states, is we already had a syndromic surveillance system. And since we already had a syndromic system, that means we've already got the chief complaint fields from hospitals coming into our agency. So we just need the definitions, the syndrome, to be able to search those and identify counts for heat illness using either a narrow definition or a broad definition. We didn't have to start from scratch. We called our wonderful colleagues in New York City and worked with them to actually develop the same sort of definitions that they were using for narrow and heat. And within a matter of days, when we first got the grant, and then within a matter of days, we were able to stand up a syndromic surveillance system for heat. And we're now running it every summer. So you can think about it, even though we're not seeing a lot, those are fairly small numbers, it has a sensitivity to see something if it was really big, and we've now had 3 summers of testing it. And now, in addition to the fields from the hospitals coming in, we also have our EMT runs. So we have those fields as well to track it. So now that's in place, that we have it. We've started to think about vulnerable populations. And one of the things about Maine is we have the third highest percentage of population above 65. And it's well established in the literature that the elderly are more at risk for heat. So we have a lot of them. They're more at risk. So you would expect if you started to look at hospitalization data, see evidence for increases in hospitalizations or ED visits as a function of age, and sure enough, we see the same thing. So this is both us building capacity to look at it this way, to track it this way, and sure enough, we're seeing the same thing that's reported in the literature. One of the best ways to deal with heat, they say, is access to air conditioning. We've already heard that talked about with our colleagues from Massachusetts. If you look at data that comes from, for example, the U.S. Energy Information Administration, you can see that in the Northeast, generally, about 90% of homes now approaching have access to AC. But try to find that data for Maine. You can't. It's really hard to get this down to more of a local level. So we put a couple of questions into our state behavioral risk factor surveillance syndrome survey to try to get an estimate of access to AC in Maine. And the current estimate is 53%, so a lot less than the 90% you saw for the Northeast. And big differences by region. So if you live in down east, it's more like 20%. If you live down in southern Maine, in York, you're approaching 70%, and that gives you a sense of the variation in access to AC. The other important thing to find out was that the vast majority of this AC are window units. And the reason why that is of interest is there's only a limited amount of literature about the effectiveness of AC in reducing morbidity during heat events, and the little that is out there suggests that access to central air is more effective than window units. So here we are, we have half the population with AC, but the vast majority of that are window units, and so clearly we're not all that well prepared for it. And so now you've got to be thinking about shifting that over the next decades, hopefully before anything major happens. And unfortunately, the same counties that have the highest proportion of people over 65 are the same counties that have the lowest AC. So that's another sort of way of thinking about vulnerability. We'd love to be able to make those great maps I saw that Minnesota has. I don't know where we'd get AC data at. That must be, what, census block group level? So, yeah. I don't know where we'd ever get that. So now let's talk about threshold for heat advisories. And for those of you who are not up on this, the National Weather Service has the Northeast and really the country split into regions. And depending on where you are, there is a specific heat threshold that is used to determine when they issue a heat advisory. So for the Northeast, it's a heat index of 100 for, I think, 2 days for a couple hours. And then New York City was wondering about whether or not that was actually appropriate for them. I won't steal their thunder other than to say they did a wonderful time series analysis, published their work, and it was sufficient evidence to convince the National Weather Service to have a specific threshold for New York City. But I've already said that in Maine we have one of the highest proportions of people that are elderly. We also have very little AC. So is there any reason to think that people in Maine would be any better adapted for dealing with high heat than, say, people in New York City. Probably not. But we actually, through our funding, have the same sort of analysis that New York City has done underway, and hopefully within the next couple of months we'll wrap that up and then be able to make our own case to the National Weather Service about whether or not we should have a different threshold for issuing a heat advisory in Maine. And this is just some simple descriptive statistics. If you just look at counts of ED visits for heat illness over time and then look at the number of days of with a heat index between 95 and 100, it looks like there's a pretty good relationship there. So I would be willing to bet that when we complete the time series, we're going to see results not dissimilar to what New York City saw when they did their analysis. In terms of forecasting, one of the really beneficial aspects of having this funding is we've been able to develop a working collaborative relationship with the University of Maine Climate Change Institute. And what that's enabled us to do is have them do downscaling model for us, where they take the global models, circulating models that are out there, do downscaling to give finer resolution for Maine, as well as to be able to give us specific information about areas of Maine. So if you want to ask the question of, in 50 years, what will heat look like in Maine, as compared to, say, what it looked like in 2006, 2010, they're able to do that for us and then help us prepare tables or charts like this, where we can ask, will we see a substantial increase in the number of days with a heat index above 95? It looks like anywhere within the next 50 years, 3- to 5-fold increase. That's quite an increase for a place that doesn't have a lot of AC. These are the sort of results that get people at the local level to engage with you and start talking about, oh, maybe we should start thinking about this. Maybe we should start to develop our own heat response plans. And that has really led to where we are now with the grant, where we're working with both at the state level and at the local level to start to develop these heat response plans. There's plenty of those that are out there elsewhere in the country. We can learn from those. The trick is engaging local people to work on this and getting them to take their limited resources and apply their resources to this problem. But we're having some success in doing that now. And I think that's it. So these are the people doing most of the work for us. And again, thanks to CDC for the funding.